Well, today we're going to start a three-week mini-series on the Old Testament book of Ruth, which means, among other things, that you'll get to see me the next 2 weeks as well. The person I planted to do that just was right on cue. That was great. I think you'll find it relevant on a number of different levels. It certainly fits with a lot of what I'm going through in this season of my life right now, personally. But I do need to warn you, the last time that I preached on Ruth was at Community of Hope, and I took 11 weeks to do it there. So buckle up. There's no on-ramp to this one. Here we go. Let go and let God. Is that good advice? Yep. Many of us have said it. Most of us have heard it. Some of us have probably made it a motto that we try to live by. What does it mean to let go and let God? Well, certainly at one level, it's a call to trust God, and trusting God is always a good thing to do. But it's also a dangerous thing to do. Because as Larry Crabb writes, unless we're trusting him for what he's promised to provide, the step after trust is disillusionment. We'll get angry at God for not doing for us what he never promised that he was going to do for us. And then, unless that anger gets worked through, we'll settle for a distant relationship with him. Maybe we'll go through the motions, perform religious duties, but we've decided that we can't exactly trust him, whether we've admitted that to ourselves or not. And he's certainly too dangerous to be intimately close to. Unless we're trusting him for what he's promised to provide, the step after trust is disillusionment. Let's look at the book of Ruth from the perspective of her mother-in-law, Naomi. The stage is set for the whole book in the first paragraph, and so we need to dive deep right there. Bill read it just a few minutes ago, but we need to take a step back because there's a whole bunch packed into that first paragraph. The book begins as the curtain is pulled back on a happy family of four, a man named Elimelech, his wife Naomi, their two sons Mahlon and Chilion. Now, the fact that the only one of those four names you can probably pronounce is Naomi does not mean there's anything strange about this family. We have every reason to believe that they were a happy, faithful family, striving to serve God while going about their daily tasks. Particularly in that culture, having two boys would surely be seen as a sign of God's blessing on the family. Do you know what the word Elimelech means? It means my God is king. And did you catch it? There was an interesting little cue in those first few words. They're from Bethlehem. Well, that's good. Good things come from that little town of Bethlehem. How still we see thee lie. It has all the markings of a feel-good story from the beginning. Well, the first cloud on the horizon is that there's a famine in the land. No food anywhere to be found. Unless something changes, this happy family of four is going to starve to death. So they travel to the other side of the Dead Sea, to the country of Moab, as refugees looking for something to eat. There was another clue given to the background of this family in that first couple of words. It says that all of this happened during the days when the judges ruled. And that means that the Israelites had already experienced the fulfillment of most of the promises that God made to Abraham. They were living in their own land, the promised land, land that God had provided for them through Joshua. And so undoubtedly, when they packed up their belongings and headed to the not promised land of Moab, they were looking forward to the day when God would bring them back home to the land that he had promised to them. I wonder if they said to each other, let go and let God, as they were marching over to Moab. God will take care of us. We can trust him. Verse 2 says they went to Moab and they lived there. And just like Jesus said, God knows our needs. If he can take care of the lilies of the field, then he surely can provide for what we need. Verse 3 is the first fingernail across the chalkboard. It says that Elimelech died. So now Naomi has to bury her husband in a foreign land. She does, though, still have her two sons with her to help and care for her. And verse 4 says that her sons married women from Moab. Was that good news or bad news for Naomi? Yes. Yes, it was. She would have shared in the joy of an expanded family, but she also knew that according to Deuteronomy 23, verse 3, nobody from Moab was allowed to worship with the Israelites down to the 10th generation. Her family would never be able to worship together. Surely a huge part of Naomi must have wished she were back in Judah so that her boys could have married nice Jewish girls. There's heartache mixed in with the blessings and the joy. Well, the final faith-rattling blow comes in verse 5. After this family of three, now plus two, had lived in Moab for 10 years, we read that one of her sons dies. And then the other son dies. Naomi has now lost everyone she brought with her from Judah. What happened to God's promises to care for this faithful family of four when they left the promised land? Verse 6 tells us that Naomi heard that the Lord had come to the aid of his people back home by providing food for them. I'm not sure how Naomi might have reacted to that, but here's a guess. Sure hope he's not caring for them like he cared for me. Might have been something like that. Whatever the case, she packs up once again along with her two daughters-in-law and starts to head back to Judah. What a difference 10 years makes. Had the Naomi of 10 years earlier passed this Naomi, I'm not sure they would have even recognized one another. Naomi manages gratitude toward her daughters-in-law for their willingness to accompany her back to Judah, but she encourages them to stay back in Moab. She says, "You're very kind, but you need a life. You need to find a life for yourselves, and you're not going to find it with me. Stay here while I go back home alone." Imagine that you were one of the people in Judah to see Naomi come walking up the road after all her loss. What would you say to her? Pastor Mark Raton, my pastor here in Tucson, and some of your pastor as well, when I was in college, believed that God was calling him to a church in the Seattle area. It made no sense because his older daughter Angie was in med school at the U of A. His youngest daughter Julie was just getting ready to enter the U of A on college scholarship as a softball player. His father-in-law had just moved to be near Mark and his wife Elaine. Ministry at church showed all kinds of promise and no good reason to leave. As Mark and God wrestled over this call, Mark distinctly heard God say to him, "Mark, I'll take care of Julie." She was diabetic. "Let go and let God." So Mark took the call and moved to Washington. A relatively short time later, Julie died in her sleep of a diabetic coma. I remember Mark saying to me, as I'm sure he said to plenty of other people, "Well, when God said he was going to take care of Julie, I didn't think he meant that." What do you say to Mark? What do you say to Naomi? What do you say to people who've trusted God, acted on that trust at great personal sacrifice, and then something like this happens? What do you say to yourself when you're disillusioned or struggling or wrestling with those kind of faith-rattling doubts that come when really hard times come along? Well, we'll look more closely next week at what Naomi said, but here's a sneak preview. She said, God did this to me. And she said it not once, but five different times in the first chapter, let alone however many other times she said it that aren't recorded. Naomi mourned publicly and privately, out loud and silently, in full color and surround sound. It wasn't pretty, Naomi's mourning. How would you advise Naomi? Now, if you happened to notice today's totally bizarre sermon title, here's why it's there. It's because if we're not careful, we can end up sounding a lot more like Buddhists than Christians in our response to suffering. Trust God, a person might say, and trust Him so fully that all other desires become as nothing. Like Jesus said, don't let your hearts be troubled. Assuming that you could figure out a way to tell Naomi that without it just being incredibly callous, would that be good advice for Naomi? Actually, it's closer to Buddhism than it is to Christianity, that advice. Maybe you've sung this little chorus, turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in His wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of His glory and grace. It's a lovely little song, but if it's misunderstood, it can reflect more Buddhism than Christianity. So, a little bit about Buddhism. Gautama Siddhartha was the son of a wealthy king, a prince whose father prepared him for the throne by shielding him from everything ugly. Against the wishes of his father, the young prince decided to venture outside the castle walls to see what he could find, and he came across four distressing sights that unnerved him: a sick man, an old man, a dying man, and a seeking man, one who wanted to unravel the mystery of suffering. These sights troubled Gautama so greatly that he decided to make it his life's mission to understand suffering and to discover its solution. One day, after a great deal of time and thought, he arose from under the sacred tree and said, I am Buddha. And his awakening consisted of the four noble truths that make up the core of Buddhist teaching. Here they are. Number one, life is suffering. There is always in everyone's life a gap between desire and reality, and that gap is suffering. Two, the cause of all suffering is desire. People suffer because it's not possible to have everything you desire. Three, the way to end suffering is to end desire. Want nothing, and then nothing can disturb you. And number four, spend your life learning to eliminate desire. The Eightfold Path, the way of Buddha, shows you how to do that. Buddha's advice to Naomi would be to deaden pain, to train yourself to feel less. What would Jesus say? Not deaden pain, but deepen desire. Feel even more. Jesus intends to awaken within us desires for Him that are so strong that all other desires are put in their appropriate place, and here's the key, without being weakened. Let's compare Christian view of suffering to Buddhism. One, instead of life is suffering, The Bible teaches that life includes suffering, but life is good. Jesus came that we might have life and have it abundantly to the full. Life isn't to be shied away from, it's to be embraced. Number two, instead of the cause of all suffering is desire, the Bible teaches that the cause of all suffering is separation. Paul tells us that the whole creation suffers out of its separation from God. Separation from God is at the root of our suffering. And when we don't realize that our deepest God-created desire is for Him, we head off on a wild goose chase to try to fill it with all kinds of other things. And even if we get what we want, we can end up suffering. Number three, the way to handle suffering is not to try to eliminate it by ending all desires, but to dive deeper into your desire for God. When we can approach life from this understanding, everything, good or bad, can be used by God. No tragedy has to go to waste. We can trust that God is at work behind the scenes, whether sin directly caused the suffering or not, and that God can draw us closer to Himself through anything. And finally, number four, spend your life learning not how to eliminate desire, but how to discover your deepest desire and how Jesus alone can satisfy it. Let go and let God do that. I mentioned the last time I hear, which I knew I was probably going to be doing this sermon on series on Ruth, so I already gave you the first two parts, you just didn't know it. I mentioned the last time I was here that the Lord wants to bless us, and Jesus loves us so much that He won't settle for anything less than the very best. He's working at all times to bring us into deeper relationship with Himself, and sometimes His blessings can actually get in the way of our relationship with Him. The good things in life can actually become the enemy of the best. And when that happens, God, out of His love for us, will sometimes remove those good things that are getting in the way. I'm not saying that's the explanation for all of it, but sometimes that's part of what's going on. God did not abandon Naomi. God did not abandon Mark. And God will not abandon you or me. Ruth knew a little bit of something about lifeless gods. She had spent her whole life worshiping them. And as we'll see next week, Naomi's rather unconventional approach to evangelism actually worked. Ruth decided that a living God, the kind that Naomi was wrestling with so painfully, a living God was far more attractive than a lifeless, soul-deadening idol like she was used to. Jesus invites you this morning to His cross, where His word of encouragement to you is not to deaden pain, but to deepen your desire for Him. Don't try to deaden pain by being less alive or by distracting yourself to death or by covering it up so you can't see it or feel it or by self-medicating. Bring it all. Bring every hurt to Jesus because He's quite capable of addressing anything that we might bring to Him. And in that invitation, I want to extend you the opportunity, if you so desire, to do that in a tangible way. And during this next song, maybe you want to gather at the rail or up at the altar. If you're really wrestling with some things this morning and would like to bring those to God, it's okay to do that physically. After the service, I would be happy to pray with you, or I'm sure there's plenty of other people that would be willing to do the same. But today is an invitation not to deaden our pain or our fears, but to enter into them and trust that God can handle it, whatever it is that we might be going through. Amen.